This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Welcome back. So yeah, we're going to look at Ecclesiastes and Something New Under the Sun. This is part two of three, of course, and each lecture is looking at a different theme, the three biggest themes of Ecclesiastes: vapor, joy, and the fear of God. We're going to crown it off with the fear of God. Save, in my opinion, the best for last. And the vapor theme, you can think of, this was an attack on idolatry. You know, don't take life too seriously. Don't worship the things in this life except God. And then this is an attack on contempt for the world. Life is a gift to be received and enjoyed from the hand of God. That's something of what's going on here. So the title of this one is called A Table in the Mist, which is, I mentioned this yesterday, the title of an excellent book by Jeffrey Myers. He is, I think, a PCA pastor in St. Louis. And this is one of the best introductory books to Ecclesiastes. If you want to get a book that just is short and concise, to the point, this one, along with the other one I mentioned, Living Life Backwards by David Gibson, they're both excellent introductory books. So the table, though, the table in the mist, that's meant to give you an image, really an image of joy in the mist. So a table is what? It's where you gather with friends and family to eat and drink and have conversation, to do good and joyful things together. That's the image of the table. That's the image of the table in the Old Testament. To eat and drink at a table, this is a sign of celebration, of goodness, of a full life. And so the table should remind us that life is meant to be enjoyed. And yet, joy, like everything, is vapor. You could come at it from the other way. You could say mist, within the mist, everything from top to bottom, out to the outer edge. There's no escape from the mist. But look, the assembler says, there's a table in the mist. That's what this is meant to give you an image for. So this finding of joy, this losing of joy, this coming and going, this is one of the tensions and the challenges of Ecclesiastes that it addresses, that we address in life. And so it's wisdom for the way. So in this call to joy, the assembler is dealing with what is tragic at the same time. It's what we need to do. And that's not always easy, this call to joy with what is tragic, especially when life goes dark. As expressed in this poem, this powerful poem. This was found on a wall in Auschwitz, written by an anonymous inmate, recovered sometime later. And it goes like this. If I could make this move. Oh no, it's not plugged in. One sec here.
The third way you turn in the US.
Yeah. Okay, here we go. This is, I don't know if there's a title for this, but this is the poem. There is grace, though, and wonder on the way. Only they are hard to see, hard to embrace, for those compelled to wander in darkness. That's the sentiment here in this poem is something of the sentiment in the book of Ecclesiastes, I think. And How could someone write that and do that from that place? I don't know. But if they could do that there and then, it gives me hope that we can do it here and now, in whatever darkness or wilderness we've been compelled to wander in. That there is grace to see the wonder and the joy that's coming our way, that's on the way. It is hard to see. It's hard to embrace, but not impossible. There is grace from God to do this. And believe it or not, I think there's grace for that in this book of Ecclesiastes. And I think that's surprising to people, because the assembler, otherwise known as the teacher or the preacher, said everything is vapor. And so it's hard to move from that and to think he could be a preacher of joy. And so instead they imagine him many times to be a crotchety old preacher or a pessimist who's given up on living, or a desperate godless hedonist trying to maximize pleasure and minimize pain as much as possible just to get by. But he's much more than that, I think. As Uni Lee mentioned yesterday, he's neither this pessimist nor an optimist, as some think he is, but rather he's a faithful realist. And whether we think he is that or not, that is the bigger call of the Bible, to neither be a pessimist nor an optimist, but a faithful realist as we face the tragic and as we face the face of God. So I though think he is a preacher of joy, the assembler, and he's calling us to the table in the midst of the wilderness. And what he says not as some philosopher who's lived in an ivory tower, but from experience. This is hard-earned information he's giving us. So we looked at this passage yesterday. We're going to look at it a little more in detail today. This is chapter 2. And this is what he says. I said, I, to my heart, go on now. I will test you with joy and show you what is good. But look, this too is vapor. Of laughter, I said madness. But joy, what can it do? I searched with my heart how to lead my flesh along with wine, my heart still guided by wisdom, and to grasp folly until I could see what was good for the sons and daughters of Adam to do under the sky for the number of days that they live. This is what his quest is all about, and these are some of the tensions he gives you right off the bat. So this doesn't come out in most translations, but there's this I myself that's in the Hebrew that doesn't come out. But the idea is, the point is, I'm not just talking about in the abstract. I myself am doing this and experience this. This comes out of my own life. And this also doesn't come out in most translations, but he has a dialogue partner, and that dialogue partner is his heart. So he says, I said, I, to my heart. There's this constant telling, talking to his heart, and sending his heart on a mission. So his heart is his companion, and wisdom is his guide in the book of Ecclesiastes. That's really helpful to see. And he sends his heart out on a mission to see what is good. And it's joy that's put to the test. Go on now, I'm going to test you with joy and show you what is good. This is practical wisdom for practical living. This is what he's into. Go on now, I'm going to test you with joy, but look, this too is vapor. So yeah, life, it's meant to be enjoyed, but life, joy, is vapor. It comes and it goes. Of laughter, I said madness. Laughter never lasts. As Cormac McCarthy put it, the novelist, the shadow of the axe hangs over every joy. And that's maddening. But this is no reason to give up and throw in the towel. The assembler presses on. He always presses on and always tells you to as well. But joy, what can it do? Don't think it's been fully answered at this point. Just because he says it's vapor doesn't mean that's the end. Just because he says life is vapor doesn't mean that's the only answer to that question. So he presses on to find out what joy can do, and he drinks wine. He becomes acquainted with folly without ever becoming a fool. He tries to understand folly. He looks at it as many angles as he can. But he says, in all of this, my wisdom was with me, as he says later in the next passage. So again, don't assume that this was just some sinful endeavor. Wisdom doesn't allow you to do that. So his goal wasn't just selfish hedonism. It was to see with his heart, down to his core, what is good to do? What's worthwhile? What's the good life, basically? What can the children of Adam do? And that's actually the language in the Hebrew. It's the sons of Adam, the children of Adam. And time is of the essence here because we're the children of Adam, and that means our days are numbered and lacking and can't be counted. So time is of the essence. You don't know what's coming tomorrow. So he engages then with his great experiment of joy, which I'm not going to read again. We read this yesterday, but I'm going to talk about this more right now. So the assembler, he moves on from the more, you could call the more passive pleasure of drinking. That's not bad because it's more passive, but he moves on to now the more active pleasure of assembling. Okay? And what's he doing? He constructs these most extravagant buildings and gardens, and then he fills them with abundant vegetation, animals, and people. Does that remind you of anything? Genesis, creation, exactly. So this is similar to what God did in Genesis, right? Out of the chaos, God makes these hospitable places, the land, the sea, the sky, and then he fills them with animals and fish and people. And then it says what? God saw what he had made. He saw all that he had made, and behold, it was good. This is the language of delight. This is God delighting in the works of his hands, and that's exactly what the assembler's doing. He made all this stuff, and then he said, look, man, I had joy in this, delight. He too saw all the works he had made and said, whoa, look, that's not bad. And this reminds me of the time in Switzerland. We were living in Chalet Malaise, and these two big trees had to come down. And they were just sitting in the lawn, and I thought, what could I do with these? What if I make something with these? I'll make some furniture for the lawn. So I made this huge picnic table, and these chairs to go around it with a chainsaw, kind of chainsaw art. I made like a fort for Adam and this chicken coop. It was a lot of hard work. Super enjoyable, though. And then at the end, I was just standing there thinking, hey, that's not bad. It's pretty good. I felt a little joy in the work of my hands. And I think that's part of being made in the image of God, is imitating him. He makes something good, and then he pauses to enjoy the work of his hands. And that's part of what work should be for us. There should be something in our work where we step back and we say, hey, not bad. That's pretty good. Enjoy it. That's part of the work of enjoyment. But, of course, we'll see later. I looked at the work of my hands, and I knew one day all this stuff is going to turn into sawdust. And that was a little depressing. But it didn't mean it was meaningless. Just meant it's fleeting. It's not going to last. So, the assembler imitates God because we're made in his image. We're meant to make culture. We're meant to do things. And of course, the assembler goes over the top here. We don't always have to do something so extravagant. And you'll see the assembler never points back to this and says, all right, in order to have pleasure, to do well with your life, you've got to do something extreme like I did. He's going to give us more ordinary things to enjoy. But we're not This is not presented as something evil and corrupt just because you're building and assembling. But he wants to go to the full extent here. That's part of the passage. The point is, he doesn't want anyone to be able to say, you know what, you just didn't go far enough to figure out what you figured out. He wants to say, I'm going all the way with this pleasure thing, this joy thing. See where it can take me. What can joy do? That's what he's after. So, again, he says, wisdom stays with me here, so we shouldn't assume necessarily that he's oppressing people like Solomon did. He's Solomon-like, but it doesn't mean that he oppressed people in this assembling. It doesn't mean he broke any God's commandments in doing this. Not necessarily. Although I think, again, this is also at the same time maybe poking a little jab at Solomon, like we said yesterday, because Solomon did go too far with his building projects. But yeah, most importantly, what did he see? Well, again, like yesterday we saw that joy, he says, joy was in my heart. This joy went all the way down to his core. This is not just some passing pleasure. It was passing, but it was something he felt, and that was good. And this was his reward. This was his portion. But it didn't last. And so he says, what did I make? I made a sandcastle, in essence. And one day, a wave is going to wash it all away. And this, of course, creates a tension in this book. But a tension we're supposed to feel and work through and gain wisdom for and figure out how to work with. Because for the assembler, enjoyment who enjoy the gifts of God in this world is not some optional extra. It's a matter of life and death to the assembler. So he uses as much poetic strength as he can muster to bring this across to us. And again, I think we're supposed to see this is poetry. This is supposed to be a bit exaggerative at times and strong, and maybe satire is part of the mix in here. So hear what he says here. Here is something tragic I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on the human race. God gives a man riches and wealth and honor, and he lacks nothing he hungers for of all he desires, but there's no ability from God to eat it. That's the literal word, eat it. Enjoy it is how it's translated because it's meant to be about enjoying. But eat it is the word that's used. Instead, a stranger partakes. This is vapor and a tragic sickness. And then he gets even stronger. Even if a man fathers 100 children, these are good things you should be enjoying and receiving. And even lives many years and the days of his years become abundant. Good days from God are a gift we're supposed to enjoy. And yet, his hunger is never satisfied with the good. Then even before his burial, I say, the stillborn is better off than he. Though in vapor it comes, and in darkness it goes, and in darkness its name is shrouded, though it never sees or knows the sun, this one has more rest than that one. Even if he lives 1,000 years and 1,000 more, but fails to see what is good. It's strong. It's poetry, of course, so it's meant to be strong. But to be stillborn is to be better than to never see and take in the good things of this life from God. That God's given you. That's right in front of you, maybe. In your work. In your family and friends that are right there. In a good meal on the table. In a sunrise or a sunset. So to eat and to see, these are both literal and metaphorical instructions on how to enjoy, how to live the good life. They're both literal and metaphorical. You gotta see this. And better to be dead than to never do this. That's what the assembler's saying. This is not a call to suicide. Never does the assembler say, therefore, throw in the towel and kill yourself. Never. This is a call to living. This is a warning. You can be worse than dead before your funeral. But this is a powerful call to live life in the fullest sense of the word. That's what this is here for. That's why he's saying this. It's better, he says, to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For this is the end of human fullness, or of every person, you could say. And the one who is alive keeps this in their heart. Frustration is better than laughter, for a troubled face makes the heart glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of the fool is in the house of joy. So what's going on here? Do you feel the contradictions? You should. It's intended for you to feel them and be like, what the heck's going on?
Kind of like the Beatitudes.
Kind of like the Beatitudes, exactly. So listen to this. This is from Leonard Cohen. If you know his music, I've done a lecture on him. There's a crack in everything. The Broken Hallelujah guy, if you know him. So he said this in an interview, and this relates to what's going on here, I think. He's been called the Godfather of Gloom, by the way. He didn't appreciate that very much, but if you listen to his music, you may understand why he's been called that. But this is what he says. The heart just cooks like shish kebab in everybody's breast. And we all live the life of the heart. And we all just try to make something out of the things that happen right in front of us. The heart, though, is not triumphant. It's filled with defeat. And it's filled with moments when you think you can't go on. And to have those moments named by a song, not just mine, but by anybody's, is slow and melancholy, and it just makes you feel a lot better. And I think that's so true. And I think that's something of what's going on here. And it's really interesting. If you look at Leonard Cohen, I mean, he spent his life writing these quite sad songs dealing with the tragic aspect of life. And you see him later on in life in interviews and in his performances, and he looks like one of the happiest guys you've ever seen in your life. And I think because he spent his life doing this. And because, yeah, there's a lot of tragic stuff that our heart encounters in this life. And so the heart carries around a lot of sadness, a lot of anger, a lot of frustration. And to have that named in a song, to have that named in a poem or in Ecclesiastes, that can help make the heart glad. That's good for the heart. The heart wants to be able to say that, express that, get it out. So in a sense, yeah, blessed are those who weep, for they will laugh. It's one of the Beatitudes. So I think, yeah. And when something is sad or tragic, we don't just express sadness so we can get to joy, but that's an appropriate response to what is tragic, to life that is tragic. The Assembler says it in some extreme terms that still are uncomfortable for me. At one point he says, I hate life and I hate my toil, as he's considering the death of life, the death of his life's work, the death of every joy, his own approaching death. He hates that. But he never calls us to give up, and that's not the only thing he says about life. He says life is tragic, and it's painful, and it's frustrating, and it will anger you, but don't give up because of that. Life is also a gift to be enjoyed. And I think we see this not just with the Assembler, but with the psalmists. They are constantly doing this, engaging in really strong language, that tragic element, what's called lament. And I think we see that. And that's, I think, emotional wisdom for us. That's been emotional wisdom for me. I still need to learn from. I'd rather go around the difficult emotions than go through them and to joy. So that's where I feel a corrective, that we need the corrective of Jesus when he's at the tomb of his friend Lazarus. And he's weeping bitterly, it says. And it says, actually, Anna has pointed this out in her teaching, that the language, when he says he's enraged like a horse, a raging horse. It's very strong language. That is emotional wisdom before what is tragic, before death. And I think that's something of what we are being offered in the book of Ecclesiastes as well. I remember I have a mentor of mine, I've mentioned here before, James Houston, who was a mentor of mine at Regent College. I think he's 96 now and still teaching. But he told me about this one time, this student he had met years before came up to him and said, Dr. Houston, tell my friends over here what you told me years ago. And he was like, I don't know if I wanted to tell them because it was just one sentence and it was kind of strange, but I felt like I was supposed to say it. He said, well, what I said to her is, stop smiling. Because she wore a plastic smile all the time and never was honest with what was frustrating and tragic and sad in her life. And so that freed her to do that. And then it led her to true joy in the end, and so that she had authentic joy on her face when she saw him. So, you're going to see with the assembler, he's going to say these hard things, but he then never says, all right, throw in the towel. Give up on wisdom. Wisdom is limited, but he never says, well, stop being wise. Keep being wise. Life is hard and tragic, but that means you've got to live it all the more. And much of how we're going to enjoy life is going to come down to how we interpret it, how we see it. So that's one of the assembler's favorite words for enjoyment is to see the good. If you don't see the good, you're not able to enjoy the good. And so it's crucial. And this can come in not just for things that we typically think are good things, but even for things that are difficult. So His sense of enjoyment encompasses more than just the easy, delightful things we normally encounter, but will even encompass some of the more difficult aspects. It's going to bring this all under enjoyment. It's going to be a mixed bag of goodies. So an example here is outside of Ecclesiastes, but this is in James. Maybe I don't have that here. This is from James. My brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of any kind, consider it all joy, because you know that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let endurance have its full effect, so that you may be mature and complete, lacking in nothing. So I think the important phrase there, it's not there. It went away. Okay. what's that?
Vapor.
It's vapor. Everything's vapor. Boom. consider it all joy. So that doesn't mean make sure you feel that it's only an all joy. Consider it all joy is interpret it as a bigger, as a part of a bigger joyful picture. This ending where you are lacking nothing, as James says it. So, there are bits in life that are terrible bits by themselves. But God can work those terrible bits together with other bits and make them something good into a bigger joyful picture. That's what Paul talks about. He works together all things. By themselves, the bits can be terrible. But work together, they can be part of a bigger, joyful picture. Which means, though, in this age, joy is always going to be a mixed drink. A mixed cocktail of pain and sorrow and joy. Tears of joy is what we get in this age. And sometimes that's more tears than joy, and sometimes that's more joy than tears. But I think in this age, it's probably always something of a mix. So you can even see when you suddenly encounter something beautiful and good, you start crying. And why is that? It's because you're still in this tragic world But joy is confronting you. Beauty is hitting you. And it just brings everything out of the heart. So for the joy set before him, Jesus endured the cross. That was the picture he had. That's what he was going for, the joy set before him. That's the bigger, joyful picture of his cross, of every cross, of God working all these bits together for good. And Jesus says, this joy, this is a joy that he's going to give us, is that a joy that nobody can take from you. John 16:22. Here's a joy of the new creation. He's the new assembler, right? He's assembling a church and he's assembling a new creation. And the joy that he's giving us in this new creation, from this new creation, is a joy no one can take. A joy that's no longer vapor. That remains. That's something new. That's something different. That's something to rejoice over. But that doesn't make the first assembler now irrelevant, I think. Because we still live in between the times, right? We still live between the already and the not yet. Eternal joy that's coming is spilling into the present, but it's not yet fully here. Mortality has not been swallowed up yet by immortality. We're still in the mist. So the Ecclesiastes is still relevant. All right, with that, we're going to look at what's called the joy passages. All right, there's seven joy passages highlighted, what's called the Carpe Diem passages, the Seize the Day passages. They're somewhat similar, but there's important slight nuances with each one. And it's as if the assembler is here in these passages pointing us to the table in the mist. Say, look, here it is. Go there, eat and drink in the presence of God, before the face of God. But each time he does it, he's giving us a slightly different angle. And he's doing it with greater and greater intensity and urgency, which you will hopefully see as we go along. So this is passage number one. Here it is. There's nothing better for people than to eat and drink and bring their hunger. The word there is soul. Soul can mean hunger. It can mean appetite. It can mean your life. They bring their soul, their hunger to see good in their toil. See, the word see is bigger than just our physical eyes. I myself also see this. That it comes from the hand of God. So who will eat and who will enjoy other than me? Indeed, to the good before him, he gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy. But to those who miss the mark, he gives the task of gathering up, then handing over to the good before God. This too is vapor and hurting the wind. So the assembler has all kinds of words for enjoyment. Eating, drinking, seeing, are the most common, which again have literal and metaphorical meanings. So yeah, just to eat and see the good, to eat and see good things is just enjoyable to do, right? There's nothing better than gathering around the table with friends and family with good food and drink and conversation. We believe that here. We do that all the time. Every day. We believe in that. But eating and seeing are also descriptive of how we enjoy life and other good things. So, as I mentioned, yesterday or already today, we typically enjoy what we perceive to be good. So there could be a beautiful landscape in front of us. But if we aren't attentive, if we haven't learned how to perceive the good in that landscape or that sunset, we won't be able to enjoy it. We're disconnected from it. And we don't just need to be able to see it We need to be able to take it in. We need to be able to eat it, drink it. That's what's going on here. So you see someone at the Grand Canyon, they're at the edge there, and they're just, eyes are open, their jaws dropped. What are they doing? They're just taking it all in. They're eating it, so to speak. So what's good for the children of Adam to do? Again, that's what he's after. It's to see and to eat the good things that are all around you, that God has given you. And therefore also to see that these are coming from the hand of God. That's part of the joy. That's the culmination of the joy. I, myself, also see this, that it comes from the hand of God. Anna has pointed out in her lecture that the hand of God, means it, the hand represents the will and the wish of the entire person. When you hear the hand of God, that's what's going on. So the wish and will of God is for us to see and receive his good gifts that he's giving us, and to see them as coming from his hand. That's his wish and his will for us. On Mondays, we sing this hymn, "My Shepherd Will Supply My Need," during our prayer meetings on a regular basis. And there's this line I love: "Thy hand in sight of all my foes doth still my table spread. My cup with blessings overflows. Thine isle, thine oil anoints my head." Of course, this is about Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd. But this is the image we're supposed to be seeing here. God spreading a table for us in the midst with good things for us to see and enjoy. It's coming from his hand for us. So there's a way we can be attentive to joy and human flourishing. Human flourishing is a big focus right now, not just for Christians, but for other people. But we can do this in a way with God to our backs, so to speak, and become blind, therefore, to the hand, the divine hand, that is giving us these good things. We can miss the mark. To miss the mark is a word for sin or the sinner in the Bible. That's the way this is just translated usually. But that's the word that is used here, the one who misses the mark. Because they have God to their back, so to speak. And therefore, they can't see the hand from which this is coming to them, and they're missing out on the greater joy of seeing that hand. So that limited vision equals limited joy. But greater vision, seeing this come from the hand of God, equals the greater joy, the culmination. It's kind of like, you know, you have a song, and then the final part of the song where it culminates and completes the pleasure is there. And so many times that's missing in people's joy, in their supposedly fuller life. So, we can't control when God gives good gifts to us, what God gives to us necessarily, how God gives us. We can ask, but we can't control. I think that's one of the big points of Ecclesiastes. But we can put ourselves in a better position to receive his gifts. So the assembler says, "Who can enjoy other than me?" So is enjoyment just for people like the assembler who could do that crazy thing in chapter 2, these huge grand buildings and stuff? Is enjoyment just for someone like him with those kinds of resources and wisdom? No. It's for anybody who is, quote, good before God. It's for anybody who just turns around and turns to the hand that is giving them good gifts, to live before God in that way. The good life is a life lived before God, turning to him, receptive. The empty hands of faith open to receive from his hand. So, an enjoyment doesn't come from just stuffing ourselves with more and more stuff. This is another big point of Ecclesiastes. We can't look at all the passages that talk about this but rather it comes from savoring. Right? Savoring a good meal. Savoring a friendship. Savoring skills that can meet a challenge. Savoring meaningful work. Or maybe just work that pays the bills and puts food on the table. So we're not to be greedy. Greed is one of the things that he attacks throughout the book. We have a portion, a limited portion we're to enjoy. And that's all we need to enjoy and to savor. So we need to learn to be content. And we need to beware, in the words of Walt Whitman, to beware of being demented with the mania of owning things. Isn't that great? That's from Song of Myself. But to beware of being demented with the mania of owning things. There's a lot of illustrations in Ecclesiastes that would be saying that. But joy, it's never this isolated thing. So maybe a lot of people, I think, hope if they could just take a pill and that would give them joy. But that's not what joy is. Joy is joy in something good. And so that's the practice of joy, is learning how to do that, how to delight in good things that are coming to us. And so, yeah, may God give us eyes to see. Maybe that's Paul's prayer. I pray that the eyes of your heart would be enlightened to see the inheritance that's coming. We need vision to enjoy. Number two, I'm spending a lot of time on these first two, but then it will get shorter as we go. I know there's nothing better, again, for them, but to rejoice and do what is good in their life. And what is more, the fullness of humanity, that they would eat and drink and see good in all their toil, this is the gift of God. And I saw that there's nothing better than when people rejoice in what they do, for this is their portion. For who will bring them to see what will come after them? So the big point here, this nothing better kind of life, again, the main point is, well, this is a gift from God. This is what he's given you. And I find that this part in Paul's sermon in Acts 14 really summarizes this and really a lot of the teaching of Ecclesiastes, where he says, God has not left himself without a witness in doing good, giving you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons and filling you with food and your hearts with joy. That could be right out of Ecclesiastes. But that's what's going on. But back to the table and the mist. Notice the additions to this passage. The nothing better good life here is described as rejoicing and doing what is good. That's a phrase in the Bible that means living the moral life. Doing what's right, what's good, what's your moral duty, in a sense. So Deuteronomy 6:18, do what is right and good in the Lord's sight, so that it may go well with you, and you may go in and take over the good land the Lord promised on oath to your ancestors. So to do what is good, this is responding to God and his moral commands, really. So what's interesting here, though, is that to rejoice and to do what is good, they're linked together. These are coming together. So not is it only enjoyment and human fulfillment a gift from God, it's turning into something we are obligated to do, a moral imperative. We're going to see this becomes even stronger by the end. And then a lot of this comes, this is the first time we see the word portion. This is your portion. Or your lot in some translations. And of course we eat our portion at a meal, but we can also have a portion of land. That's what the Israelites would have thought of when they heard this. So when Israel entered the promised land, everyone was given their inheritance, a portion, a lot of land to live on. And so this was both a gift from God and a task. So they still had to build their homes, they had to till their gardens, they had to make their meals. And so joy is both a portion, but it's both a portion that is a gift and a task. So God gives us a portion of possibilities and abilities, and we must do something with them. We must rejoice in what we do. And I think the more we see eating and drinking and working as a gift from God, the more you're able to do that. It goes back and forth, and joy starts increasing in your life. So life is vapor, it's frustrating, but it's also a gift. And to see that is joy in itself. Number three, look at what I myself have seen to be good, to be beautiful, to eat and drink and see good in all one's toilsome labor under the sun, during the number of days God gives to them to live. This is their portion. And good isn't limited to what's only in my toil, but it's anything that's going on. It could be God's work that we're seeing. What is more, the fullness of humanity, when God gives someone riches and wealth, and he gives them the ability to eat it, to take up their portion, and rejoice in their toil, this is the gift of God. Indeed, they barely call to mind the days of their lives, because God keeps them humble with joy in their hearts. So things are getting amped up here. Joy is not just the good thing to do, it's also beautiful. And I would say, who did this more beautifully than Jesus? Talking about himself, he said, "The Son of Man came eating and drinking." That's the language of Ecclesiastes. And so much so that he got this reputation of being a glutton and a drunk. Maybe he was taking Ecclesiastes a little too seriously, some thought. But he said, wisdom is proved by her deeds, by her children. So I think Jesus lived Ecclesiastes, the wisdom of Ecclesiastes, better than anyone else. And he fulfills it in a way beyond our imagination. But he did it so much so that people said, man, that guy is eating a lot of people. That guy's a glutton. And look, his friends are just sinners. Jesus saw things differently. But why did he think he was drunk? Why did they call him a drunkard? Well, why do you call anybody a drunkard? Well, you think they've just had a little too much. They're laughing a little too much. I think Jesus must have been so joyful, and his meals must have been so joyful. They thought, man, there's a lot of drinking going on. There must be. Because I think a lot of us, we have this picture of Jesus being maybe sad and somber all the time. But I think this maybe gives us a glimpse into his joyful nature, where he said he rejoices in the Holy Spirit. And I think he goes farther than the assembler in joy and eating and drinking. This is, if you want to get a good understanding of this, listen to Tim Keller's sermon, The Lord of the Wine. It's a powerful sermon, and it got me to listen to it just recently. And then he talks about Jesus being the Lord of the feast also. And so at the center of our worship, in the midst of the wilderness, what does he do? He calls us to a table with bread and wine that are going to satisfy us forever. And he eventually calls us to this feast in the coming age, the banquet, where he is the Lord of the feast with unending joy. All right, it's hard to go back to Ecclesiastes after that. But the gifts of God here are not just the good things God gives us, but also the ability to enjoy them. What good are the good gifts if they're out there and they don't get in here? We need to take them in. And without that ability, we're missing out on what God intends for us. So, it would be wise, if God is the one who gives us these abilities, is to say, God, could I have these abilities? Could you give me the ability to take in what is good? Teach me the art of receiving my portion. And it's an art that we need to be taught. This next one summarizes in two sentences what we've been talking about. It's a short, pithy little saying that is helpful to keep in your back pocket. On a good day, be in the good. And on a bad day, see or look. Even this, along with that, are made by God in such a way that anything after someone is not to be found by them. So on a good day, be in the good. This is a kind of seize the day. Another instructive description of enjoyment. So we've been, up to this point, it's been see the good. Take it in and eat the good. Here, be in the good. Immerse yourself in the good. And I love that Cole loves this saying. So a lot of times when he goes off to work or school, I'm like, Cole, be in the good. And he does. He's really good at it. He's always in the good, wherever he is. But this is the only time this phrase comes up in the Bible. You don't see this in a lot of translations again, unfortunately. This be in the good. But it's a phrase for enjoyment. And here now we've moved from praise and commending joy to command. Be in the good. And this is a big switch from the first half to the second half. The second half has a lot more you fear God. You be in the good. And enjoy, I think, is a very close approximation for us. The prefix N in enjoy is in. In joy. Get in the joy. And so when someone says that to me now, I hear people, you know, I love it when people say that. Enjoy. You know, I'm out paddleboarding. That's usually what you hear on the water. Enjoy. I'm like, enjoy. Well, now I hear that not just as a friendly gesture towards one another. I hear that as a command from the assembler. Enjoy. You better. Get on with it. And not only on good days, but on bad ones. Consider it all joy. So, again, up to this point, it's been see the good. And this phrase here, on a bad day, see, in the Hebrew, just kind of cuts off. It's abrupt. But even this day, this bad day, along with that one, has been made by God and given to you. You don't have access to any other day. That's the way God set it up. You have access to this day right now, this moment. How are you going to see it? Well, you should see it in the words of Psalm 118. This is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. That's what's going on here. And that doesn't mean it's always going to feel good. Again, that's going to be a mixed cocktail of a drink. It might be tears of joy. It might be more tears than joy on certain days. But he still lifts the glass. L'chaim. To life. That's what the assembler is doing. And that's what he does next. And I myself made much of joy. That there's nothing better for people under the sun, indeed, than to eat and drink and enjoy. And this will join them in their toil during the days of their lives that God gives to them under the sun. So see here, he's lifting his own glass. And it can be a mixed drink. But he's lifting it to joy, and he's lifting it to the God who gives him this joy and days to rejoice in. And there's an Anglican prayer that I pray on a regular basis that I think fits this really well. And it goes like this. As we rejoice in the gift of this new day, so may the light of your presence set our hearts on fire with love for you now and forever. I think that is the sense you should get from Ecclesiastes. That's what Ecclesiastes should get you to pray. So here what we see, joy is starting to break in now into even the bad days. Not just the good days, but the bad days. It's going to join us even in our frustrating toil. And it's about to go everywhere else. As we finish with the last two passages. This is chapter 9, verses 7 to 10. Go. Feel the command there? Go. Eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a good heart. For God has already approved what you do. Let your clothes be bright or white. Yeah. at all times. And let not your head lack for oil. See life with the woman whom you love all the days of your vaporous life that he gives you under the sun. All your vaporous days. For this is your portion in life, and in your toil at which you toil under the sun. Whatever your hands find strength to do, do. For there is no work, or additions, or knowledge, or wisdom in the grave where you're going. We feel that urgency, the strength. We're back in command mode. Go delight in your bread. I love that, you know, when someone's deathly ill, it says, we say they've lost the taste for bread. And in French, actually, that can mean a way of describing someone who is dead. They've lost the taste for bread. Don't do that. Delight in your bread. Drink your mixed cocktail. That's a mix. Let goodness go right down to your heart, to your core, and change your core with a good heart, it says. Because God has already approved of all this. His yes is over all of this. He's saying yes to this. You've already got that. This is his wish and will. This is his hand. So rejoice with bright clothes, white clothes, all the time. Of course, bright clothes, I always think of Anna. She's always dressed very brightly, and she's ready to celebrate all the time in that way. But this language here, this was meant to be reserved for the festivals. You do this kind of eating and drinking and dressing for when you're celebrating the feasts. What's he saying here? Do this all the time. So now joy is breaking out of the festivals even, out into ordinary time. Into all times and all places. Rejoice in the Lord always. So you can say, we have a saying around here, the Lordship of Christ over all of life. This is about the joy of the Lord over all of life and in all of life. And I'm reminded of these lines by Over the Rhine, where they were talking about the trumpet child, and that's Jesus. The trumpet child will lift a glass, his bride now leaning in at last, his final aim to fill with joy the earth that man all but destroyed. And this joy, it's not a solitary joy. A lot of times people present the assembler as this isolated individual who's promoting an isolated joy. That is not the case. If you pay attention, he's constantly talking about joy with others. And he laments. He saw this vapor under the sun. There was this one without a second. This guy who's working and working endlessly. And then he says, who am I working for? And then he goes on to say, two are better than one, for they share reward, a good reward in their toil. As Francis Bacon said, he figured out the equation here. He said, you know what friendship does? Friendship doubles joys and cuts grief in half. And he kind of got what the assembler was saying, I think. And then, though, he goes on and he says this. And this is worth hearing about. Cast your bread upon the water, for after many days you will find it. Give a portion to seven, or even eight. And maybe you heard, oh yeah, this is about foreign investments or something. And Uni Lee says, no, no, no. That's not what's going on here. Listen to what she says. She says, this call is not a metaphor for foreign investments, but a call to perform charitable deeds with abandon, without calculating the potential returns. The earliest interpreters understood the text in this way, and similar proverbs from other cultures support this reading. So in this Egyptian text, for example, we find, do a good deed and throw it in the water, and when it dries, you will find it. Or an Arabic one says this, do good, cast bread upon the waters. If the fish does not know it, God will. And then he goes on, actually there's a lot of in the scriptures to say that this language is about sharing. Share your bread. Give the very bread that's your sustenance, that you're enjoying, share that joy with others. To 7, even 8. So we're moving here from friendship, the goodness of 2 or 3, to the goodness and the greater joy of a flourishing community that's generous with one another. And in this text, though, it's see life with the woman you love. So earlier, the assembler talks about finding the woman who is a trap. And he says, this is more bitter than death. And then he moves on, and this is what I've seen in my translation, is he finds this man among 1,000 more. So he just doesn't find one man, he finds 1,000 more. Some of the translations say, I found one man who was upright. That's not in the Hebrew. That comes later, but that's not in the Hebrew. He says, he found one man amongst 1,000 more, and he didn't find a woman with any of them. It's all these single guys out there who don't know the goodness of being with a woman. So there's being trapped by a woman, and there's being with the woman you love, and seeing life with her. All your vaporous days, filling all your vaporous days. So I think he would say to those 1,000 that he saw, look, dudes, you're not getting any younger. Go find the woman you love. Be with the woman you love all your vaporous days. That's the kind of joy he's talking about. And so whatever your hands find to do, do with all your strength. What gives you strength? It's the strength of the joy of the Lord. The joy of the Lord is our strength. Whatever God gives you passion for, whatever he gives you joy for, within his moral commands, do it. Get on with it. Give yourself to it. Don't wait for a rainy day. That's what he's saying. And now for the grand finale. And sweet is the light, and a good thing it is for the eyes to see the sun. Even if one lives many years, in each one they should rejoice. But let them remember the days of darkness, that they will be many. Everything that comes is vapor. Rejoice, you who are young, in your youth, and let your heart do you well in the days of your youth. And walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes. And know that for all this, God will bring you into judgment. And put away frustration from your heart, though, and remove evil from your flesh, for youth and the dawn are vapor. And remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the bad days come, or the years when you will say, I find no pleasure in them. And then what follows is the ode to death that we heard yesterday. But to be alive, or to see the sun, is to be alive. In other words, the assembler is saying, it is good and it is sweet to be alive. So we need to see this in light of his earlier, I hated life because of what tragic stuff happens in it. I hated my toil. But that's not all he said. He said, it is good and sweet, though, still, to be alive, even with that frustration. So we should rejoice, therefore, in every day and every year that God gives us. Because one day the sun will set. One day it will be otherwise. As Woody Allen put it in one of his characters in a movie, live as if every day will be your last. One day you're going to be right. That's Woody Allen for you. But yeah, whatever youth you have and vigor you have, and I think you can even have that in your older age, rejoice in that, whatever it is, whatever degree you have, rejoice in it and rejoice with it. Because like everything, it dissipates like the morning mist. Let your heart do you well. Walk in the ways of your heart, in the sight of your eyes. These are just different ways of saying, live your life to the full. Right now, this day, this moment. And know, for all of this, God will bring you into judgment. So make sure you're doing this within God's moral boundaries, of course. But make sure you do this. That's the bigger point. So listen again. This is to Uni Lee. This is by Uni Lee. And we just got about 2 minutes left here. By appealing to God's judgment, the sage lends his counsel of joy all the weight of a divine commandment. He insists more strongly than ever that enjoyment is the will of God for which human beings will be held answerable. Or as a text in the Talmud has it, everyone must give an account before God of all the good things one saw in life and did not enjoy. So, to remember your Creator is to remember that. And now maybe you're feeling a bit of the fear of God. And there's more of that coming this afternoon. But when we moved to Switzerland, I broke my leg skiing within the first few months of moving there, when we lived at Le Brie there. And I had this full-length cast. And we lived in the Swiss Alps in the winter. So frustrating, to say the least. But when the time, I don't know how many weeks later, came for me to go to the doctor and take it off, I went there, we took it off, and I said, all right, now what? And he said to me something I'll never forget. He said, go. Live your life. Wow. Those are the best words I've ever heard in my life. Yes. But I hope you've heard that from the assembler. With all that we've heard in light of it, go live your life. And live it to the full. Thank you. But questions up here for discussion. We don't have to talk about all of these, but these are up here at least for you to consider. I got these from a book that's something of a spiritual direction book, and I thought they were very helpful questions when it comes to joy and joy and sorrow too in the mix. So you could maybe look at those as we're chatting and think, is there one of those you would like to talk about? I especially I like all of them, but this one. Have I ever experienced joy and sorrow or pain at the same moment? That's something like what we've been talking about. But yeah, this is a time to interact with what you heard just a moment ago, or something on the theme of joy and joy in life and the difficulty of that. So, yeah, there.
I do have a question. Do you mind putting up your translation of the first verse of chapter 2? I was sort of, my mind went back to our theme weekend on joy from a couple summers ago, and I was just reading along with the...
that one or the one?
Chapter 2, verses 1. It's about... So in the ESV, it's translated, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure, enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? But I was struck by how you render it here, and the way it seems to set joy apart from these other things of like pleasure, laughter. So I hear a difference. I said to my heart, go on now, I will test you with joy and show you what is good. But look, this too is vapor. I laughter, I said madness. But, I think it was the but that got my attention. But, joy, what can it do? And I was curious about the choice of but there rather than and.
Yep. And it's vav in Hebrew, which can be and or but or yet or, you know, you have options. And so that's a lot. But the question there, what can it do? I think that gives the context of the book is a but. But joy, what can it do? And, you know, it sounded kind of... yeah, so that was a choice. That's not a necessary, but I think in the context and what comes, he's on a mission. to see what it's capable of. What are its limits? What's the tragedy that comes with it, the struggle, the frustration, but also, what can it do?
I mean, this, to me, this rendering, it draws out a hopefulness, or like, that even under sort of a blanket of discouragement or potential cynicism, like, there's still this edge of like, and yet, is there something else? You know, a different way of understanding joy, or how you, I like how you, just described how do we grow in our ability to eat the good things in life, like grow in receptivity.
Yeah.
I guess an observation that I just was intrigued with here.
Yeah, and this, what I've tried to do in my translation is be as literal as possible, and I found the more literal it went, the more poetic it was. I mentioned this yesterday. And the more clarifying it becomes. It's less ambiguous than what we would think. It's ambiguous enough, the book. But I think if we, let the words speak for themselves. And joy, too. We were talking earlier, I was talking with Marty about there's a choice. You know, you'll see pleasure in some and joy in others. But joy is the more usual translation of that word. But pleasure makes it sound like, oh, this is just a pleasure seeker. This is... I'm trying to maximize pleasure and minimize pain just to get by. But his search is way more serious than that, I think, as you see. This is not just some, coping mechanism. He's very serious. What is good for us to do? What's worthwhile? What are we going to do with our one wild and precious life? In the words of Mary Oliver. That's kind of what the thrust is. So that's... But joy. That's what I feel through the whole book.
I guess Ben isn't here right now, but Ben Kais, when he was at graduate school, did his master's work on putting together a gospel choir and composing music, and then they had a concert. But and the theme he wrote in paper, but it was on joy and suffering, which is a big theme in gospel music. And it's something that struck us being members of a black church and just being exposed to this amazing, our pastor is so committed to celebration. Anything that can be celebrated, whether it's kindergartners graduating from kindergarten to Martin Luther King Day or whatever, we're just looking for things to celebrate and the reality of joy, but we had never been in a church that so faced suffering head on and pain and the reality of racism still, and then it just struck me, one of the choirs, there's a number of choirs in our church, one of them is called Joy in the Morning. And I've always thought, and I think it is morning, like, you know, like after the dark when you wake up. But maybe it's also meant to be morning, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. I need to ask them. Both, but that, you know, that they're both there. And Mr. Schaefer, one of your questions was, the question you just mentioned, do you experience both at the same time? Mrs. Schaefer used to say that all the time, is that we never have the luxury in this life of total unmitigated joy or total mourning, or total grief, because we're having to experience those two emotions at the same time, and it's really hard.
Yeah.
It's really, really hard.
It is, yeah.
And obviously we're weighed one way than another, and at times it may be overwhelmed by one or the other, but don't wait very long and you're dealing with both.
Yeah. That's really interesting. Yeah, and that's where we need to make room for each other for that. I think we're used to dealing with things that are quite simple, and so to deal with somebody and ourselves that are dealing with both, to making space for that. Something we're not patient with. I mean, especially on the sorrow end, we're quick to be like, especially as Christians, to move on quickly to joy, and we don't have enough room for lament. I think that's I mean, the spirituals and the gospel music out of the black community, it's priceless.
Sure.
There, and that's what makes them so rich, and what we're lacking. I mean, I think we lack lament, and how it's part of this journey to joy. That's an important first step. And it's not a step we ever fully step out of in this age.
Can I just say, you mentioned last night a tragedy this week that your friend of ours was killed in a car accident, and there's like a condolences page. And exactly what you just said, there are already people, and this is a horrific, violent death too early in this person's life, and already people are saying on this condolences page, well, you know, God knows what he's doing. Mm-hmm. You just got to trust God. And, of course, there's, like, a good heart behind that. And I think, of course, we're on the road to that. Mm-hmm. But it's like the Psalms. I mean, think about how much room is given to just, why? You know, where are you, God? Like, just freaking know to death and to violent death and the death too early. And I think that's something, yeah, that the church hasn't always been good at, but we do have a rich history of lament, just crying out in confusion and anger, and to not have to pretend that that's not there,
yeah,
and that somehow that's faith. Mm-hmm. Like David Powlison in his book Suffering, God's Grace in Your Suffering, he talks about the emotions of faith in a way that I love, because he includes all emotions as the emotions of faith, as opposed to just the kind of happy, clappy ones.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's, there's a book that deals with joy in the Bible. The Bible and the Pursuit of Happiness. It's a really interesting book. They deal a lot with positive psychology in there, but one of their main points is this, like the psalmists, the Bible never goes around the difficult emotions. It doesn't avoid them, but goes right through them. Engages them fully. And I think that's not our bent. We tend to think of the negative emotions as the one we should suppress that aren't part of faith. But in fact, they are. And I think the assembler would also say, you know, we're quick to figure out what God was doing with this accident.
Yeah.
And we want to be like, oh, this is what God was doing, blah, 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 fill in the blank. Mm-hmm. And he's like, no. You don't know. Mm-hmm. You know he's good, and you know he's going to take care of this person. But we don't know why this happened. So don't say anything about that. Be agnostic there. Know what you don't know, and know what you do know, kind of deal, and make that clear distinction. I think that's what you see in the book of Ecclesiastes. You'll say, this I know, this nobody knows, this one who knows. And I think we need to figure that out in our own lives. What is for us to know, and what is beyond our knowing, what's beyond our grasp? That's constantly what we're wrestling with. Joshua?
A quick question. Step out at the end. What was the seven joy section? What was the last one? Is that at the end of 11?
It's 11, yeah. 7 to 12, verse 1. I mean, I think I would stretch it all the way to the beginning of 11. This is where people typically start it. Just because, like, the sweet is the light. But cast your bread upon the waters.
Yeah.
I just think that's like, can't control himself.
Yeah.
Start sharing, then share the joy. My dad would always say, if he shared something with them, somebody, he would always say, double joy. You know, like, still says it. And so, you know, you share, that's with two or three, you know, but then what happens when you do it with seven or eight? You know, cast your bread, give to seven, even eight. Like, it's really expounding, you know. What's double seven joy? Oh, yeah, I don't know. Sarah, then Ben.
To just sort of make too much of numbers here, but do you think there's something to 7 and 8 and the anticipation of the new creation with the number 8?
I mean, 7 is typically a perfection number, yeah, and so to go 8 in the Bible is to go overboard, like, you've just gone beyond the fullness, like, so you're spilling over, but yeah, I mean, I don't know. That sounds great. It takes, you know, a poet to kind of see that kind of stuff.
What's 8? What's the relationship between 8 and the new creation?
Well, the 8th day would be the creation.
Okay.
Jesus rose on the 8th day,
okay,
in a sense.
All right.
The beginning of the new creation.
I'm just going to ask you, like, if going with this, like, question number a better, my question after what was the seventh was, like, do people see it as then, like, because the significance of the number seven and having these seven sort of breaks in, is it, do people read into that as that is sort of a way that the form is communicating also sort of the message? Because it was very helpful for you to pull out these themes of Jewish. Some of these I've seen, I haven't seen all seven before, but it's hard to, or it'd be natural to assume that this was sort of a deliberate way of kind of drawing your attention to these.
Yeah. You know, Uni Lee is the one who you know, she's read way more than I have, but she's the one who focused, this is the scholarship that she's come across that narrows it down to seven, but she doesn't mention anything about it being seven.
Yeah.
But I find that interesting. Yeah. I mean, why seven? And not only that, but we're going to look at the fear of God passages. There's seven references to the fear of God, three of which are in one passage. But it's like, you know, that seems pretty purposeful.
Yeah.
So there's a PhD maybe you could go for.
Yeah,
why not? Well, that's good. Yeah.
Okay, so they just did a big thing on the Sabbath and sevens, and it's amazing.
Is it? Okay. I bet it is. They do good stuff. Yeah, the Bible Project, if you haven't encountered that, that is a really good resource. Whenever I come across Joshua in his apartment, he's watching the Bible Project. No, it's doing more than that. But, it's really good. It summarizes books of the Bible really well.
This is the podcast, though, not the
video. Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. The videos are good, too, but the podcasts I haven't listened to. You've listened to me, Joshua.
Some, yeah, not
all. Someone else? Question? Adam, was it you?
So, one thing I think is quite interesting about, like, the mist is, I saw one of the suggested questions you had up there had to do with, like, science and a lot of, like, development. It seems to me like there's a tendency, and even in myself, to kind of relate joy with simplicity, or even with poverty, right? Or with, you know, we have too much, right? Technology gets in the way. And then if you think about how people sometimes dedicate their lives to developing something, you know, that will last for generations, some sort of technology or anything like that, some breakthrough. How would you, it's kind of a weird question, but how would you relate that to the sense of mist? Because it seems like we're, you know, building these things in life, which maybe has to do with the toil. And, you know, we wouldn't deny that technology or wealth is good, in a sense.
Yeah.
But also it seems like it gets in the way, you know what I mean? So, like, it's mist, but also it's almost, it becomes like an idolatry type thing.
Yeah. Exactly. I think that's like the, well, I think that's again the double-sided thing in Ecclesiastes, at least what I see, but in the Bible as a whole, it's an attack on idolatry of the things of this world. We're not supposed to idolize them and think of them as ultimate significance, but we're not supposed to show contempt towards them, and they're still good gifts. We're still meant to work and do good things and be engaged physically, you know, dominion. God giving us dominion on the earth is go be creative. Reflect your creator who made this beautiful world out of a chaotic, you know, the formless void. We're to imitate that. And there's joy in that to be found. So that's that double-sided thing, I think. And I think a lot of people will get the first part, well, we're not to worship the world, it's vapor, therefore show contempt towards it. And that was kind of St. Jerome, that was his take. And that kind of stuck, but it's like a lot of asceticism was fed by that. But just because we're not to worship it, doesn't mean we aren't to enjoy it and do good things with it unto God. And there's great joy to be had there. And I think we've missed out on that. And so that's, a lot of Ecclesiastes, the word for work is all the way through it. So it's about work being cursed in Genesis, I think. And what's it like to work like that? And how do we still find joy despite that? And what was God up to even with the curse? Because there's even progression in Ecclesiastes. Maybe we'll see a bit this afternoon. But you kind of see this progression in Ecclesiastes from vapor, toil, to joy, to God. Mm-hmm. Being led by the hand the whole way. And then you get to him standing before him in fear. It's just another kind of joy. Thoughts? Anna.
Yeah, I was just going to respond more to that. You know, like recognizing that it's a myth. Like, I guess I'm thinking of Gus's question, like science and technology, things that people make, things that people pour out their lives for that might, you know, help generations. It seems like Ecclesiastes wants you to remember that it is going to evaporate, whatever you do. I know this is kind of the whole progression of the whole weekend, but it's like, you have to wrestle with that first, but I love how you said that never makes him say, so just forget it. You know, just go do whatever you want. It's still like, it's right and good and can even be a joyful thing to give yourself to something that, yes, won't last, but it's still your portion. So yeah. God has given you and you can receive great joy there. So I guess I want to say, yeah, to make science, scientific, discoveries, that was the last question in your, do you remember that, your suggested
yep.
question that had to do with science?
Yep.
Yeah, it's going to shift and change and evaporate whatever you've worked on, but it's worth it.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, and I think people see that, I've heard that from people, especially who are approaching the end of their life, and the end of their life work, and they're like, what has this done? What has this accomplished? And they see it slipping away. And I think there's something of that that's true that we have to recognize and come to terms with. Of course, in the light of the resurrection, things now, we have a hope that things can cross over. And God will resurrect not just us, but our good works. And somehow there's going to be a place for what we've done, I think. That's, a lot of people have seen that in the scriptures. And so I think it's really helpful to then read Ecclesiastes in light of the resurrection.
Yeah.
And that gives a new meaning to our work. You know, so you know, Paul says, you know, our labor in the Lord is not in vain. I mean, yeah, you read that after Ecclesiastes and it's...
My question was that, do you think if the assembler or whoever wrote Ecclesiastes had the fullest picture of what God, of the unfolding of God's plan and the resurrection, would he have written it differently? Is there intrinsically like pre-resurrection kind of understanding of the temporary nature of everything? I mean, I love what you're saying about, there's a definite distinction between something is temporary and fleeting, does not make it meaningless.
Yeah.
It makes it precious. You know, or it makes it something really worth engaging with because it's not going to be around long. And but in terms of the eternal nature of say our works done unto God, like Paul's saying here, because you know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain. It's amazing. That's at the end of a whole chapter about the resurrection. So it's like, in light of the resurrection, like your work really matters. It's actually not vapor because of the resurrection. What do you think? What do you think the assembler would have had a different take had he known that the Lord would become, take on flesh and die and rise again?
Yeah. Yes. I think he would have talked like Paul. And I think there's a lot of similarities with Paul and Ecclesiastes. Even the way it progressed, like Romans, how it progresses from the wrath of God and this, people are entrapped in sin, and then eventually you get to crying out to Jesus and life with Jesus. There's this progression. And I think you see that progression in Ecclesiastes. You start with toil, but then you're led to joy and then to God eventually. And they're both like, the ways of God are beyond our imagination. You know, well, I'm actually going to show that in the second lecture. But yeah, the assembler would never have said, nothing is new, if the resurrection had happened. And you read the New Testament, and what word do you see all over the place?
New.
The New Testament, yeah. The New Covenant. All things made new.
Yeah.
It's new creation. So the resurrection, though, is the main, that's the pivot, you know? And so I do think he would be talking differently. But I think that's what I was trying to say. Well, for one, resurrect what? You know, resurrection means things aren't permanent. Like, if they kept going as they should be, there'd be no need for resurrection, but because things dissipate and slip away, you need resurrection. And so I think that's where that it goes together. And so you still need to get things being transitory and fleeting. And look, we're looking at it and our life work just slips away. But you know what? But yeah, and God's not going to let that slip away forever. He's going to seek out what slips away. I was going to get that in this afternoon, the Ecclesiastes 3:15, one of my favorite passages, and it's made a sign for me of it in our hallway, if you ever see it. God seeks out what slips away. Things are still, we're still in the midst, so we still need Ecclesiastes, but we're definitely tipped on the more already it's come in. And so our joy now, though, it's not just, well, God's going to do something with the labor, so we're going to grit our teeth until the next age. But we can still have joy, and now greater joy, in our vaporous labors, because we know they're not in vain.
Thanks. Can you go to number four?
Number four.
Oops. So the closing two lines, even this along with that, are made by God in such a way that anything after someone is not to be found by them. How do you read that final line? What's it saying in the context there?
Well, I think that this along with that are the good days and the bad days. They're both made by God, and of course, in the bigger context of Ecclesiastes, these are days that God has made and given to us, so they're gifts. Even this bad day, I think we're meant to see that. But he's made them in such a way, he's made the whole thing in such a way that you only have access to this day. So he goes into other points of the book. You know, don't get stuck in an imagined golden past, this golden age. You know, if only things were like it was back in the old days. And then he's also saying, you don't know what's coming. You can't, and don't live in this imagined future. That's not what God has given you. That's not your portion. Your portion is this day, this time, this moment. And so make the most of it. And most of all, receive it as a gift, I think, is what he's saying. Even though it's tough, and it's toil, and it's not easy, and there might be sadness in it, and misery. So that's where he's, I think, here expanding what he means by rejoicing is like James, consider it all joy. So that enjoyment for him is both an honest engagement with what's tragic and with what's joyful in life, and all under, this is all a gift from God. And even if we can't figure it out, even if we don't understand why this bad day has come, that's not for you to know. But do know this. It's made by God, and it's given to you. And this is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it.
And does he distinguish between happiness and joy in the way that... Or is that more a post-resurrection hope kind of distinction of joy being this eternally anchored thing that's not dependent on our circumstance, whereas... You know, I might be happy because I have a good meal in front of me.
Yeah.
But that happiness isn't going to last beyond that meal and is not actually going to be something that I could pin my eternal hopes to.
Yeah.
Enjoy.
Yeah, we spent a whole weekend on this kind of talk, this question you have with our, what did we call it? A happiness weekend? So, we had a theme weekend just on joy and happiness. And what? Yeah, what was your conclusion about joy and happiness in the Bible, Joshua? It was. I mean, they weren't. I'll come back to that question, but I think the bigger question. Yeah.
I said something to the effect of that because there's a bit of a formula in the Old Testament where the word for that is often translated as blessed. There's different words for blessed, but one of them is kind of like the you appropriating, like personally, God's objective blessing, and that's the word Barak, which starts the Psalms. It's all throughout the Psalter. And it's often, it's probably more, I mean, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but what I read says it's a better translation is happy. because you're actually enjoying God's blessing on you. It's not just sort of this sort of cold spiritual thing. It's like in a rich, holy way. We talked about it comes on to a certain type of, comes after a certain type of life or with a certain type of life. A life of kind of a virtue of like living in line with God's ways. So we talked about it as like the crown on a good life. Happiness is the crown of a good life. And it's your kind of subjective taking of God's objective blessing, I think, is what was said.
Yeah, so like in the Bible, though, we don't have this distinction that we have of, well, there's happiness that's temporary and fleeting, and joy that's eternal. I think we come up with those, we use words that way because we need to distinguish something between temporary joy and pleasure versus the eternal one that Jesus says, you know, no one can take away, that's unending. But that distinction is not in the Bible, from what I gather, and what others have gathered, from what I, that all that I know. But I think for the assembler, it would be, you can still find joy from the eternal one in whatever situation you find yourself in. And so there's still something of that. But he's not living in the resurrection age where there's this eternal stuff that's being promised us like it is in the New Testament. But I do think, yeah, we need some helpful way to distinguish that. So I find it's not always so wrong necessarily to talk about happiness in a temporary way, enjoy in a more eternal way. But as long as we recognize that's not in the Bible, like the Bible doesn't make that distinction. It uses the same words for both kinds of things. And not to kind of poo-poo on happiness because it's temporary and fleeting doesn't mean the Bible says, oh, it's worthless or don't worry about it. It's still a gift.
Then would the view that we have from Scripture of those concepts be more that those fleeting moments of happiness are fragments of the same eternal joy,
yes,
even if we don't always recognize them as such?
Yeah, I think so. I think, I mean, it's not like only God knows, you know, what all joy and happiness means and what it's expressing and not, but I think certainly that's got to be part of what's going on in our lives. Is the joy God's giving us is a foretaste, even if it's momentary, of what's going to be unending. And there's the poet who compiled all that poetry on joy. What's it called?
Chris
Moyne. Yeah, he has an essay at the beginning of that book, and he talks about joy being a flash of eternity. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I tend to think, that sounds pretty good. But it's also interesting because what happens when you are in these moments of intense joy? What happens to time? It's away and somewhere else. It's another poem in that book. It says it like that. And so I think it sure seems to be that joy is some kind of taste of eternity, this flash of eternity that God gives us. And he promises in Christ to have that never go away. But in this age, yeah, it's not like, I don't know any Christians who say, man, I am just in joy all the time, 24/7. Their experience of it is more coming and going still, even though it's an even more intense joy. It's a mix, and it's a coming and going.
That is interesting, the relationship between joy and time. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, when you're feeling joyful, that time seems to go by quickly, and then when you're not having a good time, time seems to like just march along.
Yes, and I think indeed they barely call to mind the days of their lives because God keeps them humble with joy in their hearts. Yeah, I think
you're not just like watching the time go by, but it's just going by.
Yeah, time is somewhere, yeah, you don't even recognize. Where if you're bored, you're just like, time is just what you're looking at. You're looking at the clock, you know. You're, so it's very different. That's, I think, that's my anticipation of the age to come. It's going to be, no one's looking at their watch.
Right. Yeah.
Time, as we know it, will be away and somewhere else. It's going to be, you know, fully immersed. Yes?
A little bit of a spin-off on that about happiness in the sense of this, these fragments. You mentioned yesterday a little bit about comedians, and also there's, in some passage I forgot, there's laughter mentioned. And it's something I think about sometimes. I've had some conversations. It seems like comedy and laughter are necessarily ironic and like satire. In a certain sense, it seems like you have to kind of find this absurd to make a joke, right? And that laughter is something of a, almost an expression of what we do before something that's absurd, or maybe, I don't know. So my question is, it seems like absurdity is necessary for laughter, almost in a sense. And so my question is, do you think that laughter, in the way that it's portrayed here, when it, in the, I forgot which verse it's mentioned in, is it necessarily tied to something bad or like absurd or something painful? So I guess my question in a clearer sense could be like, do you think, you know, we would laugh in heaven or something like that, right? Or is laughter not necessarily the same thing as joy? Because it seems like joy is like, okay, it's, everything is kind of, you know, in the eternal sense, it's perfect. And laughter would be like, you know, laugh at pain or laugh at something absurd, laugh at something that doesn't fit in.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I'm hoping that laughter is going to be coming in the next age. And like Jesus said, blessed are those who weep, that they will laugh. And a good lecture on humor is Dick's, I don't know what you call it, incongruencies perceived. Yeah. He's done, yeah.
Spinning off from Chesterton, who wouldn't say satire is intrinsic, but intrinsic to all humor is incongruity.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Not everything incongruous is funny. Flying airplanes into skyscrapers is incongruous, but not many people thought it was funny.
Mm-hmm.
But all humor, things that people do consider to be funny, are for some reason, in their way of calculating it, incongruity perceived, incongruity just jarring you. And it can be totally innocent. It doesn't even, Freud's view of humor is that it's always putting someone down, you know, never laugh until you, it's you feeling superior to them. I think that's not true at all. All sorts of things can be incongruous and funny to you or to somebody else. And of course, it's hugely difficult to make out what makes something funny, more good or not. Your age changes. What's funny to a 5-year-old, it's not going to be necessarily funny to many of us necessarily. Culturally, Jewish people are unbelievably skilled at laughing at themselves. Humor in general, they're very, very gifted at that. But it doesn't need to be nasty or sarcastic.
Yeah.
But can be, and can be one of the cruelest things at all if we misuse humor to really.
Yeah, I heard a TED talk that's very, takes a similar definition, but they said in their research that humor is, they have to convince you that what's happening is a benign violation. And so that, you know, their work is, like, say they're going to give you a talk, a joke about cancer. Well, they have to lead you up to the point where you're not going to think what they're going to say about cancer is bad or wrong, and so that you could be able to laugh at it. But you have to think that it's benign, because, you know, yeah, we hear jokes, we're like, oh man, they just went too far, and so we can't laugh.
Yeah.
But if you think it's benign, that it hasn't really, it's not that serious, then you can laugh at it, because it's like these two things that shouldn't go together, suddenly they're there, you're like, oh! You know, and it's the surprise. But back to, like, the laughter here, laughter is, it's hard to know exactly in Ecclesiastes what laughter represents, because later it comes to a point where it's like the laughter of fools is like the crackling of a pot. It's like this terrible sound. You don't want to hear it. And so I don't know if that's what he's referring to when he says laughter is madness, because you can laugh not for good reasons, or you can laugh in a godless way or in a foolish way. But it could also mean laughter just doesn't last, and so that's what's maddening about it. I'm not quite sure what he means in that first phrase, but he only uses laughter kind of sparingly. Mostly he talks about joy. Marty?
I was just going to say about laughter. there's all sorts of really good laughter, and I think of it with children, and the things that will often make a child laugh can be completely wholesome and wonderful. And I actually really enjoy our three sons have really good senses of humor, and when they're together, there's a lot of laughter, and it's not at anyone's expense, but there's something very healing about laughter, I think. And actually, there's research that shows that it can be literally that, you know, people with cancer watch comedies and laugh, and there seems to be a correlation between some sort of physical healing. And just to redeem the notion that laughter isn't always, you know, satire or cynicism. It can just be from pure enjoyment. You laugh because you're enjoying something.
Yeah.
And that I've seen with kids. One of our sons used to play word games, and he was really, even before we could understand him, he would tell verbal, he would make up sentences that were like wordplay, and then he would just die laughing at his own jokes. We couldn't understand it. One of them that I did understand was when I had varicose veins with one of my pregnancies, and Dick's father asked, you know, what's varicose veins? And this child, who was really little, looked up from his leg or something and said, varicose veins is the names of pains. And then he went back to his leg. But he would do that kind of thing with words all the time and just laugh. And then we laughed because it was fun playing with words.
Yeah.
It was really fun.
Yeah, and that can be in moments of profound grace, too.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
So like Abraham, you know, he's told, like, He's gonna get a child in his, you know, it's like 80 or 90 or something. I don't know. How's this gonna work? And he laughs, but he wasn't corrected. I think he was just laughing at the incongruity of it all.
Yeah.
Like, wait, you're saying there's a nation gonna come out of my loins? I mean, you know, kind of funny. And he laughed, and I think grace is incongruous. You know, it's like, God's gonna justify the ungodly. He's going to raise the dead. That's incongruous. And at first, that might just make you want to laugh at the goodness of it all.
Yeah.
And you're rejoicing in it. And just relishing it. And just, you know, you're being in the good, so to speak.
Yes.
So I think there's a place for laughter. But it can't, not all laughter is the same. There can be sinister laughter. There can be, yeah. It just depends. Is that, yeah. Maybe somebody hasn't. Oh, yeah. Good.
Ben's not going to quote himself, but I will quote one of Ben's songs that I love.
Yes.
It's anticipation of the new creation, I think. And it says, in the morning, we'll laugh at the cleanest joke that's ever been told at no one's expense. What does it say? How does your lyric go?
At no one's expense but God's.
At no one's expense but God's. It's just this scene of like, we'll laugh, it will be clean laughter. It won't be the kind of sinister or mocking or cruel. But there's this anticipation of clean, delightful laughter in the morning.
Mm. Yep. Yeah, I named my lecture after that. The Last Laugh. So you guys should listen to it. There's other copies out there.
I don't know.
Yeah,
I wonder if in your research, have you come across any Jewish authors sort of reflecting on this? One of the things that strikes me, as Anna was saying, is the tendency sometimes of evangelicals to say, in the midst of pain, well, there's heaven ahead. You know, we get through this life to get to heaven. Whereas I think we miss out on the depth of what the assembler is talking about here, what this life really is and how we're to live it. So I just wonder if it is useful for Christians sometimes to read Jewish reflections on this, those who believe this is the only life. So I've got to live this to the fullest.
Yeah. Are there Jewish authors that I could mention, you mean, or is there...
Yeah.
That's just, yeah.
In your research, have you come across some Jewish authors on this that really kind of had something to add, or what did they do with it?
Yeah, I mean, the Jewish culture is very earthy, and so they get, I think, a lot of what's going on here. Even you could read the Talmud that was quoted. You know, like, you're going to be held accountable for all the good things you saw but never enjoyed. that's what they got out of Ecclesiastes. But it's, you know, the dialogue within the Jewish community from the very beginning with this book has been very back and forth. There's not some full agreement they've all had and been like, oh, this is obviously about this, and let's close the book. But I think, yeah, I get the sense of like the fiddler on the roof.
Yeah.
You know, that, I think the Jewish community gets that more than maybe we do as Christians. And, you know, it's a heavy movie. I always forget how dark it is until I watch it again, and especially the ending. And you're like, oh my goodness, and yet they press on, you know? And I think that sentiment it's in the Jewish community, it's in Ecclesiastes. Maybe that's why they read Ecclesiastes in the wilderness, in their little booths, in the Feast of Booths. They're a hardy race, a hardy group of people, of course.
And they are still here. I think it's Walker Percy who said, the Jews are still here. I have never seen a Hittite wandering around in New York City. The Jews are everywhere.
That's true. I'm just looking at time. When is lunch? Or
we still have about 5 minutes. Sarah's going
to okay.
We still have a little more.
Maybe someone who hasn't asked a question yet, or someone who has. Maybe first someone who hasn't, who maybe wants to. Yeah.
So it's been really helpful to think about the difference between experiencing joy and seeing joy, or considering joy. That I think we struggle with, like, well, we have to feel joy in the midst of this horrible pain and an accident that killed someone early. And I don't think that's what he's saying, or mm-hmm. you're saying. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, how do we move beyond this feeling joy to seeing joy? How do we help me and others learn to see joy and consider it joy? Without feeling joy, because we need to feel the pain, and which we either tend to do one or the other. We like go around the pain, as you were saying,
yeah.
or we just get lost in it. And
yeah.
And this is calling us to a different way.
Yeah,
I think the whole scripture is. So talk to me more about
what
that looks like.
Yeah, and I surely don't have the full answer on this, but I think what would. Out of Ecclesiastes, it would be, well, there is a time for every pleasure and every work. There's a time for everything, and to consider, what is this time for? So, you know, we look at time and we just think of, well, what time is it? But in the Bible, it's more, what is this time for? And is this time just for weeping over something tragic? And maybe that's what's important right now. We're not going to explain it. We're not going to try and consider what it's part of. We're just going to say, this is bad and wrong, and we need to cry about this, or we need to lament, do what we need to, and within the community, not just by ourselves, but we need to have corporate lament, which we need more of, I think, in our churches, which in the Black community, I think, has done this way more than we have. So we need to learn from them, I think. And then I think it's about, again, I think this is what gathering should be, is reminding each other what the bigger picture is, you know, the bigger joyful picture of where we all come from, our Creator, and what His purposes are, and where He's taking us to, and what this trial, this momentary trial, is part of. What bigger joyful picture. And I think that helps take off the edge from... but that's something we need to do in community, I think. That's why we bear witness to one another. And we're not great at that either. Because again, I think like we've talked about, we want to push each other quickly into the joy. We want to push through the sadness and the hard things and to be done with it. And to get on with the more positive things. But that's for me, how we consider. We consider the new creation that's coming, that's breaking in. We try to fill our imagination with the imagination of Scripture that gives us this bigger, joyful picture, and to do that in creative ways. On a very small scale, that's what I would say. But maybe others have other things you could add to that. How could you consider it all joy.
I think he used the word. I think he used the word practicing joy.
Yeah.
And that just really struck me. Like, what are we like practicing? To me, usually takes time.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I don't. But also, when you said that, I was wondering: are there any clear steps people can take? Like, if you're practicing soccer, you know, you have certain drills and things you do. I don't know if practicing joy has any way,
yeah.
any set drills to it.
Yeah, exactly. I love that you said that, and that yeah, we get that wrong, and we can get better at it. And I think there is the art of joy that we need to learn. There is an art to it of this. But I think one of the biggest things we could do is to recognize the gift of things and to practice thankfulness. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what Ben's lecture is on, Thanksgiving and thankfulness. That's where you could go. Because I think that even when we just take a pause to thank God for our meal and for the good things he's giving us, mm-hmm. there's a way we're practicing. If it doesn't just become some rote thing, like, oh, this is, you know, time to pray because that's what we do. But to practice real thankfulness and thanksgiving in those moments and to make that our way of life. I think that suddenly things just open up. Your vision changes with that actual practice, I find. When I start to thank God for things, it's like I start to see more of what's there and what God is giving me and the good things that are right in front of my face.
Yeah, it's actually Dr. Houston, your mentor that you mentioned. I wrote down somewhere that he said in some talk, practice thankfulness and joy will follow. I just wrote down that little sentence from him at some point.
Yep. Yeah, which I think is a simple thing, but a huge thing, and we just don't do it. Why wasn't I doing this more? It's kind of like prayer, you know? You put it off, and then you're in it, and then you're like, shoot, this is so good. Why have I neglected to do this?
I'd say the liturgy of the communion meal as well is practicing gratitude, practicing thankfulness.
Yeah.
And then the beginning is like, lift up your hearts, we lift them up to the Lord, it is right to give them thanks and praise.
Yeah, like our Anglican liturgy is beautiful and powerful, and there's a way to just go through it, and I'm not paying attention. But man, if you really engage these prayers and this liturgy, it is helping you to see the good, to be thankful, and to eat it. Exactly. How do you end? You take in Jesus himself. It's like, oh man. I think Marty and then...
Just a quick suggestion. I just listened to a sermon by Tim Keller on Psalm 103, Rejoice in the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me. And it's actually doing... what you said, it's kind of showing you how to practice this rejoicing in the Lord. It's very helpful. It's on his, if you go to his podcast, it's a recent one on Psalm 103. It's excellent.
Yeah, and I find, yeah, just that there's one way to, like, okay, I'm going to perceive things as a gift, but then when I actually thank God for the gift, it's like, it solidifies it, it's... Mm. There's something else just happened in me and in my heart, and joy follows. So I know maybe I'm just repeating myself, but I think that's crucial. There was Ben, and then maybe one more, and then we should call it break.
Well, I mean, it's kind of what we've been talking about all along, but I think it's important not to forget that to acknowledge what's wrong and to lament it before God is actually the road to authentic joy. Mm-hmm. If we don't allow ourselves to cry out to God and to identify and mourn what's wrong, it's not that we're what we miss out on is real joy. we're trying to manufacture. Very often, I think maybe American Christians are particularly guilty of this. Like we try to downplay or minimize or not look at what's most troubling in our own lives or around us in order to maintain a cobble together some sort of sense of happiness and joy that we think we should be having, and which on some level is built on pretense. And that's one of the best ways to miss out on actual joy.
Yep.
And so there has to be, you know, the Christian hope has to be resting on something that is true despite the worst. You know, not true because we don't think about the words. You know? Yeah. And so that's why I mean, so much of what you've been saying is so valuable. Like, this is actually the way to first acknowledge what is most broken and troublesome in the world is we have to do that if we're going to expect to experience authentic joy, which is the fact that, you know, actually God has his hand on us. The end of the story is sure and certain and good. And that means something very profound if I acknowledge how terrible things are right now.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean as much if I just go about my life pretending everything's great.
Yeah.
You know, when it's not. So there's a gratitude on one hand, but also lament.
Yeah.
Both have to be alive, I think, yeah, for us, for joy to...
I've mentioned this before, I think, during one of these, when I've talked on Ecclesiastes, but the movie Inside Out, if you've seen this, so you know, it's going inside a girl's mind, and she's got these different people who are representing different emotions. One is fear, one is anger, one's shame, one's joy, and one's sadness. And joy always wants the controls, right? Sadness, you know, you go organize the books over there. I got them in control. And then everything starts falling apart, right? Because sadness doesn't get a chance. And then there's the moment sadness is allowed to take over. And she, you know, that's when she comes home, she's run away, and everybody in our family's crying. And then joy comes and puts her hand on sadness. And then a new ball. Each of them had a different color. Joy was like yellow. Sadness was blue or something.
Yeah.
But then they came together and there was a new ball with a new color. And it came out from their hands together. And I think that's kind of the... I don't know. I'm colorblind, so I don't know what the colors were. But I mean, something was happening. And but that's, you know, we're like that. We're like, you know, sadness, go over there. Because I just want joy. And then we need to let sadness sometimes take over, mm-hmm, and then sometimes together, and then boom, and to offer that to each other and to God, and that's beautiful.
Oh, I was thinking just your list of questions about, do you see joy and sadness at the same time relating to you? What you were saying is, I play a lot of funerals, and they're a moment when I often see joy and sadness at the same time, and yeah, laughter, like someone giving a eulogy, telling a funny story.
Yes.
A yeah, room can just be lifted up.
Yep.
And it's joyful and sad.
Yep. Yep. And that's, I mean, like Paul says, we don't grieve as those who don't have any hope.
Right.
But we still grieve. But not like those who don't have hope.
Right.
We have hope, so it's a mix.
Lunch is very ready.